Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And we're going to stick with this kind of revised format this week. We're going to go long on the news segment with Adam, then dive right on in to the sponsor interview, which this week is with Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences. A bunch of you would have heard my long-form soapbox interview with Zane from a few weeks back. We're sort of extending that out a bit in this week's interview. Zane will be outlining what he thinks needs to change in DevSecOps tooling and workflow for things to really work nicely. It's just a solid 12 minutes of good thinking and advice, that interview, so do stick around for that. Let's dive into the news now with Adam Boileau. And Adam, shortly after we published last week's show, the Australian government has officially proclaimed nope, no Huawei for our 5Gs. And, that's really annoyed the Chinese and Huawei quite a lot.
Yes, we've seen the Australians talk about banning Huawei and ZTE from bidding on 5G mobile rollouts in Australia. Obviously, similar sort of thing in the US. The British, have allowed Huawei to roll out equipment over there, but are concerned about it nevertheless. But the Chinese are somewhat upset, as you might imagine. The People's Daily newspaper, which is kind of a well-known mouthpiece of the Chinese Communist Party, has been offering strongly worded opinions about their feelings on the subject and accusing Australia of, not playing nicely and putting, politics ahead of trade and all sorts of other things that, are very naughty and that they shouldn't do.
Well, I'm guessing, if the party wants to rectify this, they might have to have a look at some of the laws they got on the books, because I think that's really the number one stumbling block here for them. And, it's not just Australia. We're seeing reports, too, that Japan is planning to exclude both Huawei and ZTE.
Yes, it does rather seem to be a pattern. And, for those of us that live in countries where the cell network is all full with Huawei, like, I don't know, New Zealand, does make you wonder what we don't know about. The thing I thought was really great, we have a write-up about the Japanese, the discussion of a Japanese ban and Huawei on its part there, has said that it poses no greater risk than any other ICT vendor, which is simultaneously true and not as reassuring as they'd like it to be. Because, yes, everyone is also terrible and owned by everybody. But, Huawei is of particular concern if you're in Japan.
Well, I think it's any Chinese vendor. I mean, we are putting laws on the books in Australia right now, which would see various government intercepting agencies be able to hand over technical assistance requirements, to various vendors. Okay, that's true. But the Chinese stuff just goes so much further. It's like, if any of the spooks ask you to do something, you're basically working for them and you can't do anything about it. Even applying to Chinese nationals abroad, it's really, really nutty stuff. And I think that's, until stuff like that gets cleaned up, this is going to keep happening to them. And you wonder if there's going to be enough pressure from the boycotts to make them actually look at it. And you would hope so, right?
You would, but then again, on the other hand, there's plenty of people who've just said, we'll take it because it's cheap and it basically works well. We've seen that. I mean, that's how it ended up in the UK, right? They showed up with a really good deal and, we the West perhaps don't have as much money as we used to. And, we love a bargain.
We do. I understand, too, in the UK, there was a lot of work put into transparency efforts and stuff. I have no idea if they're genuinely workable, but, there is ostensibly a transparency arrangement there that satisfied UK regulars. But anyway, point being, Huawei is having all sorts of trouble at the moment. So, that's interesting. Now, another story doing the rounds, and this is an interesting one because depending on who you ask, it's either the end of the world or it's no big deal. There's a Struts bug out there apparently already being hit in the wild. Adam, what do we know about it?
It's yet another Struts bug, which, if you've got applications that do run Struts, you ought to be pretty well used to patching them by now. So in that regard, kind of not a big deal. This one's been getting a bunch of press and... it's a bad bug in the sense that impact is remote code execution, and really the thing that makes it really bad or not is whether or not it's widely applicable. And that's a little bit more, as with a lot of things that involve the Struts and Java application ecosystem, is a little less clear. There's a couple of prerequisites for this particular class and this particular bug, and it's kind of a variant on the OGNL, object expression language evaluation stuff that we've seen in a bunch of other Struts bugs in the past. This one depends on a couple of particular configurations being set, which is the case if you're using certain like a framework, certain components built on top of Struts. One of these is the Struts convention plugin. So if you're running that, then the default configuration of that particular plugin will make you vulnerable to this bug. It's not really clear, like certainly not clear to me, how widespread that condition is and how often other people will have done the same sort of thing as a, you know, kind of as part of whatever other bits of framework they're using. So yeah, the applicability of it, I'm not 100% clear on. We are seeing people scanning for Struts, although the reports so far seem to suggest that people are scanning for Struts just because they remember that Struts is a thing and then exploiting it with older, more workable Struts bugs. So it's kind of, you know, it doesn't seem like a planet melter, but on the other hand, these, you know, this class of bugs is important because A, it's not memory corruption. Like it's typically, if it works at all, it's going to be 100% reliable, remote code exec, repeatable, which is, you know, exactly what you want in a bug. And then of course it's also really, really hard to fix these things because of the, you know, kind of complexity of Java, you know, build tool chains and the interrelationships between all of the components of the frameworks and the app runtimes and the, you know, all of that kind of rubbish that make Java devs rip their hair out. So to
fix this, it would require what, a patch from Struts and also for developers to modify their applications, or would it, or is it just a case of updating the framework and then recompiling?
I mean, typically you're going to be able to get away with pushing in a new Struts and then kind of rebuilding your app. But for many people, that's really, really difficult because I mean, Struts has changed a lot over the years and, you know, people are really reluctant to do this. And in many cases, these apps are, you know, are built by outsourced vendors or by partners or developers who've left. And, you know, they are essentially compiled binaries that no one knows how to rebuild anymore. And the complexity of the build tooling, you know, with all of the, you know, kind of Java build stuff is just, it's really difficult to roll out fixes for this kind of thing, which is why we see it languish so much, why we see people get lots of own. Equifax, I guess, is the, you know, sort of the poster child for getting owned by Struts bugs, but everybody gets owned by lots of Struts bugs. So
look, I mean, even backwards compatibility on something as simple as Drupal or WordPress was turning into a nightmare for me as someone who's, you know, been working long-term running a CMS, which is why I've moved to a, you know, statically generated site. Because, backwards compatibility with anything web is really hard.
It is, and yeah, it's simple by comparison, you know, with with WordPress,
oh, totally,
and that kind of thing. By comparison, how awful it is in Java land, where, you know, everything's terrible. And then, of course, the thing is, you know, Java by comparison to modern, you know, like Node.js, you know, server-side JavaScript runtime and build environments, my God, you know, we're going to be seeing those getting wrecked for the next 15 years as well. So everything's terrible as usual. I guess that's the summary of it.
Well, yes, it is the Everything is Terrible Hour with Adam Boileau in New Zealand. now, look, I love this story here from Washington Post. This is a bit of InfoSec drama that's been, you know, unfolding over the last few days, and it is fantastic. There's a maker of election machines, voting machines, called ES&S. And, of course, you know, some of their stuff popped up at the, you know, the election hacking village at DEF CON. A bunch of bugs got found and disclosed. The company's done its block and, you know, started writing to Senate committees saying that they should investigate this DEF CON village thing because it could be the perfect place for foreign spies to get their hands on their technology. And, you know, I'm thinking initially when this happened, I think it was Eric Geller at Politico who first got the scoop on that. I'm thinking, oh, God, this is terrible. Please, I hope the US government doesn't actually listen to this company. And much to my surprise and delight, the US government did not listen to this company and, in fact, just sent them a sweet old FU.
Yeah, which I'm so glad that we are at a point in this world where that is a thing that's happened.
That's, you know, a watershed moment. First time in my career, I'm like, the response from the government on something nuanced like this is actually the right one. I was blown away.
I mean, yeah, I guess we have finally crossed that particular Rubicon where there is enough experience with, you know, disclosure and handling of security issues that we do see, you know, political machines and people in important positions coming to the right conclusion, which is that this kind of research is good for the ecosystem as a whole, and a company that doesn't understand that really has disqualified itself from making voting machines, and they should, you know, commit corporate seppuku and let us all get on with our lives.
That was pretty much the tone of the response. And it was, you know, just such a uniform response from academics, from researchers, from government, and even from Rob Joyce, who was formerly Trump's, you know, cybersecurity advisor and who is now back at NSA. He posted a tweet saying, "Ignorance of insecurity does not get you security. We need to examine voting machines, SCADA systems, IoT, and other important items in our lives. The investigation of these devices by the hacker community is a service, not a threat." Doesn't specifically mention the vendor there, but, you know, pretty awesome subtweeting there by Rob Joyce.
Yeah, I know that's it is. It's really kind of heartwarming to see that this that the hacker spirit is a thing that is actually valued and important and is helpful here, and not just that we're not just taking corporate spin and accepting it anymore. Which that's really nice.
Well, we're going to have to slip into everything is awful mode again. So back to regular programming now. Alex Stamos wrote a post for Lawfare that was published last week, about a week ago, in fact. It was titled How the US Has Failed to Protect the 2018 Election and Four Ways to Protect 2020. But in essence, it's just a really wonderful problem statement, I guess, looking at what happened in 2016 and maybe some steps that are going to be required to curtail some of these influence operations.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good write-up. And of course, Alex, by virtue of being at Facebook, I guess has had an insight to the inside, response to this, earlier than many of us. You're right. It's a really good, statement of the problem. And he has a bunch of ideas about things that should be done about it. Certainly he has a bunch of opinions about the, extent to which the US should have responded more forcefully to the actions earlier on in 2016.
Oh, he's got some choice words for pretty much everyone. Sort of has a bit of a stab at the Obama administration for failing to act on this. I mean, I think that was a really impossible political calculation for the Obama White House, because if they started coming out and saying Russians want you to vote for Trump, I mean, it just looks like dirty politics, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it certainly was a complicated situation for them. And I'm not envious of that. But I mean, on the other hand, he makes a good point that they didn't respond coherently. And, the message is it doesn't matter what you do in the cybers, because we're too worried about having our SCADAs or whatever other critical infrastructure attacked, and we're not going to do anything about this kind of meddling that we could plausibly pretend didn't happen.
Now, look, he points out that, this type of protection role has sort of wound up falling on the FBI, which is odd, because, this is an organization that responds to things that have already happened and seeks to get convictions. He sort of talks about how the role of Cyber Command and NSA, it's not really set up to do this sort of stuff, and there's a bit of a hole there. He also suggests that legislation might be needed to, it really looks like he's suggesting legislation might be needed to get places like Facebook to do more. And I found that very interesting. It's subtle, but it's there.
Yeah, no, that also, that was an interesting kind of, twist of the knife in a way, on his previous employer at Facebook, because obviously they don't want more regulation and they're trying to, spend a lot of money and hire a lot of people to try and make this problem less visible. But, maybe his experience is a thing we should be listening to on that subject, and maybe they do need regulation.
Now, look, moving on to other sort of election hacking stuff, the Democratic National Committee incident that wasn't, Adam.
Yes, there was a bit of a hullabaloo after Lookout spotted a phishing site come up on DigitalOcean, which was pretending to be a VPN concentrator of the Democratic National Committee. They reached out to DigitalOcean to get it shut down, reached out to the DNC to have them go and investigate what had happened. And it started getting some press coverage because it had been kind of discussed on Twitter. And, oh my God, we've caught the Russians going after the DNC again, because some of the MO, did look a little bit like what you would expect. A couple of days later, it transpires that actually it was a phishing test of some sort.
Yeah, it turns out that Michigan Democratic Party Chairman Brandon Dillon said his organization had approved the simulation, didn't let Bob Lord know. So that was a bit of an issue there. Whoopsie daisy, yes. Yeah.
I mean, in one respect, I guess having an exercise that people don't know about is the best sort of exercise. And it's good that, that the Michigan Democratic Party had decided to do this off their own bat. Good for them for, testing their abilities. But yeah, maybe a little more coordination, maybe a little less everybody writing it up in the media as, oh my God, the Russians are coming. When in fact it was, I guess quite an effective test. So maybe everyone's a winner on the day.
Well, for anyone who wants to really understand some of the context around this, I published a 36-minute interview with the Democratic National Committee CISO, Bob Lord, last week. And he had some really interesting – and we recorded this like a month ago, longer than a month ago. And, he had some really interesting things to say about just the structure of political parties. Like the DNC almost operates like a franchise, right? And then you've got all of the state party branches and all of that. And it's – look, it's really fascinating when you look at how to run security for an organization like that. And he did even say back then that there's been a few incidents that that they flagged, which turned out to be people who are trying to help them, you know? So there's it's a really weird situation to be in, CISO of an organization like that. But yeah, people can go and listen to that if they want to. Now, we've got a great report here from Andy Greenberg over at Wired. He is currently writing a book, I believe, about NotPetya, about the threat actors behind that. And he's written a kick-ass feature here inside the incident response to NotPetya at Maersk. Thank God for a power outage affecting a domain control in Ghana. My Lord.
Yeah, it's a great piece. Andy Greenberg, I certainly hope it turns into a great book as well. But yeah, going inside the story of NotPetya, and in particular how it impacted Maersk. And he's been talking to all sorts of people in Ukraine and at Maersk about kind of how things unfolded. Certainly no one's talking to him on the record, which is interesting. There's rather a lot of made-up names in the piece. But yeah, it kind of talks through the experience of watching the machines around the office in Maersk, you know, kind of reboot very rapidly, you know, running around the building, you know, hurtling access control gates that had stopped working because they'd been owned, to go in and kind of unplug as many machines as they could because they had, you know, seconds to save anything, and then that leading into the, you know, the shutdown of my shipping operations and all that kind of thing, and then goes onwards into the process of trying to restore from having, you know, every Windows box in your global organization wrecked. And as you alluded to, one of the problems they had was they were, you know, attempting to get back. They found all their backup tapes and, you know, started to, you know, restore things from prior to the NotPetya attack to start getting servers up and running. Turns out they didn't have a backup of their domain controller.
But that's okay, because they synchronized them all, and they had how many?
They had dozens, right, in all sorts of places around the world. And they figured that, you know, what's the chances that all of our domain controllers are going to get destroyed at the same time? Well, zero. That would never happen. You're never going to have a, you know, an earthquake across the, you know, all of our offices at once. Yeah, they didn't count on a worm made out of eternal blue. So, yeah, they got wrecked. All of the domain controllers got RM'd, and turned out they didn't have a backup.
This is where the story just takes an awesome turn.
But it turns out that in the remote office in Ghana, there had been a power cut at some point, and the poor domain controller there had not been connected to the network and contained the only remaining copy of Maersk's global domain control database.
Yeah, and I just love this. Like, they couldn't, the guy who worked as an admin there couldn't get a visa to, like, fly out to Europe, so they had to get someone to meet him, like, halfway and, like, hand over the disc, you know. It's just crazy, and it's such fantastic storytelling, and I really loved that piece. And the thing is, people might be thinking, I know I said, you know, initially I certainly thought, well, why were their domain controllers vulnerable to Eternal Blue? But of course, you know, this thing didn't just spread via Eternal Blue once it got inside a network.
No, I mean, and that's the, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, have made jokes about, oh, well, they were running Windows XP, they deserve to get owned. But again, the reality was that NotPetya used Eternal Blue to break into things, but then used Mimikatz to steal creds out of RAM and use that to move laterally around the network. So all it took was, you know, one box, XP box, vulnerable to Eternal Blue, for which a domain admin had ever logged into. And that was the end of it. You get all your domain controls. And one of the other networks that he mentioned briefly in this piece said it was like 45 seconds from when they got owned to when everything in their network was ruined, which, I mean,
that's amazing,
really,
isn't it? I mean, you know, and that's why I'm glad to see some detailed reporting on this, because, you know, NotPetya, it is worth a book on its own. I know Andy's going to go into all sorts of stuff around that, and, you know, he'll probably tie in a lot of the attacks against power infrastructure in Ukraine and whatever. But, I mean, just NotPetya itself, that's a novel.
It really is. And I mean, real kind of, you know, watershed moment in a way. I mean, in many respects, more so than Stuxnet, because it was utilized, you know, by a nation state against another nation state, and then went way more off reservation than Stuxnet ever did, with way more damage. And, you know, the question of whether or not that's what Russia meant is kind of still up for debate. But
I believe you and I had with a friend of the show, Mara Tam, when we were over there in Vegas over a beer.
Yes, yeah, we certainly did. And I think, you know, the opinion that it was a, you know, pretty clear message not to do business in Ukraine, you know, Mara makes a compelling argument. And, you know, maybe that is what the Russians meant.
Maybe it is, or maybe it got a little bit out of hand, you know, and it was too damaging. But then, you know, Mara's response to that was, have you met Russia? So, you know, I don't know. Jury's out on that one. But you know, maybe time will tell. Maybe Andy will be able to find out for his book. So, and I'll be looking forward to that. I believe it's a while coming, though, that book. Oh, Joe Cox has a great story up here about a shakedown crew running around basically extorting businesses and threatening to ruin their online reputations with their bot armies posting negative reviews, negative tweets, you know, reverse search engine optimization to put negative reviews on the top pages and things like that. And, you know, really, when you look at this stuff, I mean, I'm thinking as a business owner, if I got approached by this crew and they started, you know, doing some of this review negative review spam, God, I mean, what are you going to do? You're probably going to have to pay.
Yeah, I mean, in many respects, it's kind of a more effective tool than ransomware to kind of monetize the technical capability you've got. Because, I mean, with ransomware, people may well have backups. You know, there might be other options. But if you're being spammed with negative reviews on every platform, you know, on Google and on Yelp and whatever else, you know, whatever other industry-specific sites, I mean, that's a really hard thing to fix. And it's not like you can just say, okay, we've got robust backups, we'll teach people not to click on links in our email and we might be all right. Like, there isn't a might be all right option here. And, you know, you look at the, man, in this case, this crew is asking for, what, like 1.5 Bitcoin? So, I mean, in the end, not a huge amount of money. You might consider it. And that's, you know, a really terrible place to be, especially when you're just trying to, you know, just trying to run a business and, you know, you don't want to get ruined by, you know, Russian hackers. Well, whether or not it's Russian hackers, we don't know. It's just coming from mail.ru. So, you know, say what you got.
Could be anyone.
Could be anybody. although, Joe Cox does note that if you try and password reset the account on mail.ru, it does have a number that starts with country code 7.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. Definitive proof. We've proven
attribution.
It. Attribution. Woo. Bleeping Computer reports that Instagram has finally expanded second factor support to third-party applications, not just SMS. About bloody time.
Yeah, you know, that's a good thing, especially given all this conversation about, you know, SIM swap and other ways of hacking SMS through factor these days. But yes, if you have Instagram, you have a high-value account, maybe you'd like to consider using OTP-based or through one of the other options other than SMS.
Yes. Now, we had some zero-day dropped on Twitter this week. Always fantastic when this happens. This comes from Sandbox Escaper. You know, we've seen this girl post 2 zero-day this year, which I just think is, you know, I mean, wow. It's clearly a very talented researcher. Apparently doesn't have a job and just, you know, likes posting O-Day. Windows O-Day. Real O-Day.
Yeah, no, this is a pretty sweet local prev-esque from like medium integrity level accounts up. So there's some particular niches where this is exactly what you want. Like if you shelled something with network service, I think is probably where this would be most useful. But yeah, her blog's got a whole bunch of pretty sweet Windows, you know, local prev-esques and Sandbox Escape kind of thing. So yeah, pretty apt name there. But it's, you know, I guess, you know, the full disclosure debate is always going to rage on the tweeters. And, yeah, sometimes people just drop in O-Days like it was the old days. You know, that's refreshing and, you know, I miss that in a way.
Yeah, and it's, I think the Twitter account there disappeared for a while. I think the Git got pulled. I you know, it was just a mess basically. But I think it's all come back now. But that one will get patched pretty quick. But funny seeing some O-Day on the Twitters. Not so funny if you're Microsoft, but anyway. T-Mobile.
Sorry, Microsoft.
T-Mobile had a pretty bad time. Apparently data on 2 million of its customers got owned. This was an interesting one because I just happened to be chatting with Lorenzo at Vice when I think he was actually first with this one. And we were just having a bit of a chat about it. And, you know, at first they were like, oh, yeah, no passwords were obtained or whatever. And then later it's like, well, you know, there were hashed passwords. And you're like, oh, okay, right? And, you know, it included the type of information that would be probably useful for things like SIM porting, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, anytime the telco gets owned, given how important they are in the Auth ecosystem, it's a big deal.
They were MD5 hashed as well, which just makes it even better.
it was pretty disingenuous that they said, what was it, quote, no passwords were compromised. And then when pushed, they said that they weren't compromised because they were encrypted. And when they said encrypted, what they mean was, you know, like single iteration MD5. I haven't seen the actual raw data, and there was some conversation about whether it was, you know, iterated or something, but either way, it did look like MD5 of some sort, and no one was particularly clear. And yes, you did actually get them compromised, T-Mobile, so, you know, stop pretending otherwise, jerks.
Yes. Yeah, so that was not particularly well handled in my view, but anyway, here's an interesting story, again from Bleeping Computer. Apparently you'll be able to log into Windows 10 soon using a Google account.
Yeah, someone from Google pushed up a credential provider for Windows that integrates with Google's like single sign-on SAML, you know, Auth infrastructure, with the intent that eventually, once they finished doing it all, that, yeah, you'll be able to drop it in as an auth plug into Windows and log into Windows with Google backing. And then, I mean, you can kind of see this making sense for, you know, organizations that don't want to move to Chromebooks but do primarily use G Suite. And, you know, maybe we'll see Google pushing out more MDM options for Windows. And maybe you'll get to a point where you can run Windows workstations, not have to run a whole Windows domain, drop into Chrome as your shell and get like a Chromos-like experience. But on Windows. Maybe that's where things are heading. And that, you know, I could see Google being pretty keen on that. I can imagine Microsoft being, you know,
less keen.
So,
yeah, no. And look, shout out to Lawrence Abrams, who wrote this story for Bleeping Computer, because he wasn't really getting much, you know, in the way of answers to his questions from Google. So he dived into the source.
Yeah, good. Yeah, good on him. According to the byline, he's the guy that like founded and owns Bleeping Computer, so clearly kind of knows what he's doing a little bit. And yeah, good to see him digging into the install scripts to figure out what it was doing, all that kind of thing. Yeah, good work.
That was a nice pickup, for sure. We got some more threat stuff to talk about here, Adam. And a great piece here from The Verge, looking at you know, what they're describing as an international hacker network. The way that they were owning the companies that distribute press releases to front run the market and basically do insider trading. It's pretty interesting, right? Up.
Yeah, it's a great and, you know, quite in-depth piece, you know, talking about essentially a bunch of Ukrainian Christians that immigrated to the US and then kind of ended up running this, you know, running this scam where, you know, some hackers somewhere were breaking into, you know, Business Wire and that kind of people, stealing these press releases and then selling access to them for like $100,000 a week kind of thing. And then people were, you know, trading ahead of the market. According to the write-up, made something in the order of $100 million, possibly more during this kind of thing, and then used it to like fund building churches in Georgia and stuff. I mean, like Georgia in the US, not the Georgian Soviet Republic. But it's really kind of a bizarre story. And yeah, loads of great details. There's one bit about one of the Ukrainian hackers that was quite deeply involved in actually doing the hacking, who gets, eventually the US FBI are investigating. They send someone across to talk to this guy. They can't extradite him. And then the Ukrainian intelligence apparatus kind of picks him up, says, you're going to do the same thing for us now. We're going to trade on that information ahead of the market. And thanks very much for your service. And yeah, it's just a, you know, it's an amazing, you know, story and write up. And it's really nice seeing, you know, because we see, you know, often when we're talking about this kind of, you know, crime, we're only seeing one little snapshot in time, one little bit of it. And seeing the whole story, like kind of end to end, is really good, you know, good for context when you're doing threat stuff to think about the whole thing. So yeah, definitely worth a read.
They did scoop up some people for trading on the information, though, didn't they?
Yeah, they ended up arresting a bunch of the people that were in the US. They rolled another one of the Ukrainians that was on a holiday in Mexico. They got the Mexicans to pick him up, say that he was being deported back to Ukraine, and then have a little, you know, side trip to Dallas, Texas on the way.
Yeah, this isn't Ukraine. What the hell?
Yeah. So no, they certainly rolled up a bunch of people, but yeah, at least a couple, one or two of the hackers in question are still, you know, kind of going about their business in Ukraine. But yeah, really good write-up, and yeah, there's some corroboration of the, you know, the involvement of the Ukrainian intelligence apparatus in profiting off this, you know, once it was identified, which, you know, is not particularly cool.
Now a listener sent me this one, and I think it's just spectacularly hilarious, and yeah, it pertains to some of Lazarus Crew's more novel ways of fundraising, Adam.
Yes, the North Korean friends have been owning up people who run cryptocurrencies, which makes a lot of sense for them. Great things to steal. They appear to be running a company that makes a piece of trading software for like people who trade in cryptocurrencies. They're making a piece of trading software, and then it's legit trading software that legit works. And then when you update it, which happens automatically on install, it also happens to install a little bit of a bit of the old back door that then gives up your access to the North Koreans. So presumably they can steal your money or your bitcoins or whatever other things that you have. There's a bunch of interesting kind of arguments about attribution here. There's a few components that share bits with, you know, previous Lazarus Group operations, previous there's a particular component called Fallchill that we've seen used by them going back a number of years, and there's some common components, common crypto keys, you know, Korean language headers on some of the HTTP requests, which, you know, maybe that's false flag, but, you know.
But I just love this Kaspersky analysis here, because you're starting to read it and they're like, okay, so there's this thing called Celas Trade Pro from Celas Limited. That's his C-E-L-A-S. And they're sort of going through it going, oh no, you know, it looks like, and you can follow what the analysts were thinking when they wrote this and started investigating it, which is, oh no, somebody's hacked this completely legitimate software provider and is backdooring their stuff. You know, this is terrible supply chain attack. And the more they get into it, the more they realize that everything about this sort of company or entity looks totally shonky, and it looks like the whole thing might have actually been constructed just for the backdoor, right? Like someone has actually created a trading platform for the sole purposes of releasing a backdoor trading platform.
Yeah, there's lots of bits where, like, the company domains and hosting and stuff are in, like, you know, dodgy crime hosting in Belgium, and
but it's all paid for by Bitcoin, which, you know, normally you'd think that's sus, but it's Bitcoin trading software. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, but no. Either way, if you run this particular thing, then, you know, this particular piece of Bitcoin trading software, then yeah, the North Koreans are totally going to steal all of your fiat as well as all of your Bitcoins. So maybe you should stop that. The campaign, or this particular write up, is called Apple Juice, because they had released a version for OS X too. So those of you who are, you know, hipsters trading Bitcoin on OS X are not immune to North Korean intrusion.
There you go. We got another great write-up here from ESET looking at Turla, which is one of the Russian crews. And I'm led to believe this is technically quite an interesting paper.
Yeah, this is quite a good write-up of a group that we've seen, you know, wandering around the internet,
for quite a while, right?
Like, for quite a while, since early to mid-2000s. I mean, there's some evidence of these this group, you know, back as far as 2009, possibly even earlier. They're quite interesting because the Turla kind of piece of malware, the piece of remote access tooling that they use, does its command and control almost exclusively over email. So it actually has like a Mappy plugin that hooks into Outlook, and it sends its command and control inside PDF files attached to emails, which of course is perfect for getting inside, the sorts of environments, you know, that have egress controls on HTTP or have whitelists for web access, that kind of thing. Email, you know, PDF attachments using, you know, fairly legit looking PDFs and just kind of, you know, embedding the C2 into that. This is actually the same crew that we saw doing, command and control using Britney Spears' Instagram. They were encoding
That was hilarious.
Domains into the comments on Britney Spears' Instagram pictures and stuff. So it's a group that's had quite a long history of using novel mechanisms for C2, running pretty advanced malware, targeting the two pieces of email software that supports is Outlook and the Bat, which is actually a common mail client in Eastern Europe and the sorts of places that Russians might care about. But anyway, it's a great write-up of the Turla malware and a bit about the tools and techniques that they've used over the years. So yeah, well worth the read if you're in that particular game.
Now, this one, I was really on the fence about whether to include this one in this week's show, but it is a kind of James Bond style hack. You know, it's sort of like a pseudo audio based Van Eck thing. Adam, tell us about this one.
Yeah, so a bunch of researchers from Israel. It's funny how all of this stuff seems to come out of Israel.
It's always Israel. Always. It's
information security group at Tel Aviv University, supported by Checkpoint, have been doing a bunch of research on using audio side channels to capture information leaking from the electronic control hardware for the displays, with the end goal being, you know, video conference with someone, record the mic, and then figure out what's on their screen based on the kind of whining noises. Those of you who are old enough to remember CRT displays, you know, it wasn't unusual to hear kind of whining and popping and hissing, you know, up the top end of the frequency spectrum from your monitor, especially it was displaying, you know, interlaced video modes or that kind of thing. Same sort of thing with LCD displays is still possible. Obviously, you know, it's up in the ultrasonics, it's pretty hard to pick up. The group or the research uses machine learning to try and reconstruct what's on the screen. So I mean, they're getting kind of data that's almost kind of like line wise rather than pixel wise, but they're able to, through machine learning, kind of map that to, you know, font glyphs or what site you're visiting or whatever. So it's not quite as good as like just Van Eck the screen via the audio channel, but still pretty cool research and, you know, novel, I guess. And
Well, it gets points for novelty and not much else, right? Which is why I was on the fence. But anyway, there you go.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty good. It's not practical. Like, it's not going to own you like Struts will, but It's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly right. You look at the top of the bullet and we go, yeah, you're probably going to get owned by Struts. And then, you know, don't video conference with anything because then someone might be able to, you know, decipher 10 pixels from your display using your audio, yeah. You know. It's just that sort of thing, right?
And don't type your password because I'll pick up the keystrokes, like the inter keystroke timing. And just don't use computers, I think, is the advice.
Oh, man, we got the best skateboarding dog ever this week, which is some sick bastard out there whose name is Felix Reiserberg has released a version of Windows 95 that runs as an Electron app.
Oh, that's so terrible. So you can get
I love the way he announced it. It was through a tweet and it says just this. I put Windows 95 into an Electron app that now runs on Mac OS, Windows, and Linux. It's a terrible idea that works shockingly well. I'm so sorry.
Oh, dear. So, yes, if you have a hankering for that, like, ratty pinball game that came with Windows 95, then, yes, you should boot up the Electron app, try not to get owned whilst you're using it, and you can play yourself some Windows 95.
Why does it work? Why? Oh, it's horrible.
JavaScript x86 emulator is just such a terrible idea. Everything, what's wrong with this world? What is wrong?
What is wrong? His apology is not accepted.
Not accepted.
Now, finally, Adam, we've got a piece here from Ars, which is more of a long-form feature that you are recommending people add to their reading list.
Ars has got this great piece a nice piece of hacker history about the history of the Romanian hacker scene, and in particular one computer lab in a university in Romania that was responsible for so many of the Romanian intrusions into things all over the world in the 90s. And of course, there's a bunch of people who work in this industry, a bunch of people listen to this podcast even, who've come out of that particular scene in Bucharest at the university there. There was a computer lab that was one of the few places that would allow free access to the internet in the early 1990s, when Romania had escaped from the grip of communism, but things were still, pretty isolated in a way, and lots of students would fight over the, 286s and 386s, old Unix boxes, Vaxen, in the lab that had internet access, and use it for all sorts of things, all the things you'd expect people to do on the internet. And, of course, a bunch of them owned a whole lot of things, NASA and, army.mil and all of the, the classic things that everyone liked to own in the 90s, showing off, owning some stuff, writing some worms, writing some viruses, writing some antivirus, a really nice piece, kind of microcosm of Eastern European hacker history, which of course has spilled over into so much of the industry. I mean, there's so many people that came out of that early virus scene, both on the writing viruses and the writing antivirus sides that have led onwards into lots of great stuff in the InfoSec world. So yeah, it's for those of us that like hacker history, of which, I'm certainly one of them, a great read, great insight into, a little bit of the scene as it once was, and actually as it probably never will be again, just because of the, very unique, point in time where you could get away with this stuff and, not get arrested.
Now, that was written by Andrada Fiscutien, and I have no idea if that's the correct pronunciation of your name, but Andrada, thank you very much for that little slice of InfoSec history. But Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Really appreciate your time, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau of Insomnia Security there. Big thanks to him for that. And don't forget, Insomnia do some pretty crazy red teaming, as well as, security assessment and review work. So if you're looking for some higher end professionals for that sort of stuff, do get in touch with them. They are based in New Zealand, but they service customers everywhere. An announcement now. Exhibitors, public trainings are coming up in a few months, and there are still some seats left. This training is happening in New York. The Exhibitor and Senrio team have found huge bugs in all sorts of software, firmware, and mobile devices. That recent Faxploit bug we spoke about on the show, those researchers used Exhibitor bugs to weaponize that research. And these guys show all of their tricks during their trainings. So for ARM exploitation training, real IoT and hardware exploitation training, and also Android exploitation, head on down to their trainings in Manhattan in November. They've been selling out trainings for 8 years straight at Black Hat. If you want to know how to reverse engineer and write exploits, check them out at exhibitor.com/training. exhibitor.com/training. And I'll put a link in this week's show notes. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences. They make web application security software. Some people will configure to use Signal Sciences software as a WAF, but it's actually a fair bit more powerful than that if you really use it as intended. It's got some anti-abuse capabilities, but giving DevSecOps teams visibility into how their applications are being used and abused is a particular strength. Signal Sciences co-founder Zane Lackey has worked as a pen tester and as an in-house security dude in a DevSecOps environment. He's just released a book called Building a Modern Security Program, and he's actually in Australia at the moment to speak at some events about what organizations can do to modernize their approach to DevSecOps. He joined me via the internet to give us a rundown on his talk, and here's what he had to say.
It's really kind of breaking down some of the key pieces of the SDLC and talking through how they modernize in this kind of DevOps or DevSecOps world. So taking a look at static analysis and dynamic scanning and pen testing and bug bounties and then visibility and kind of protection and defense.
Yeah, I find it amazing actually that so much of the InfoSec community, especially on Twitter, just argues about where these pieces belong. And the people having the arguments are usually, usually belong in one camp or the other, like they're bug bounty hunters or they're pen testers or whatever. So I, for one, am very curious to hear your view on how all of this stuff sticks together, given that, you come from that DevSecOps background and maybe have a more macro view of this. Like, so, walk us through it, man.
Yeah. Well, I guess starting in reverse there and starting with that, the bug bounty and pen test side, it's been pretty interesting for me because I've lived on all sides of that. I've been a pen tester. I've run a bounty and launched a bounty program. I've participated in them before. And where I really like those kind of the, to save anyone the trouble of having to come to the talk, the bug bounty and pen testing bit, what I really talk about is how I love that the two really complement each other. That when you're only doing pen testing, it's really tough as a defender because you're stuck with a not great choice where you can either have your pen test go very broad but very shallow or very deep but very narrow. And then you're giving up the other side whenever you do that. And so what I've tend to find in practice is that the bounties are really good for both continuous feedback and really the kind of broad but usually fairly shallow feedback. And then that frees you up to use your pen tests for very focused, very targeted assessments on particular pieces that you're most worried about. And so you're no longer having to make this really bad trade-off of only covering one side or the other.
But of course, when you work in DevSecOps, you don't want your bounty or your pen tests to really be your primary way of making things secure, of course. So, I'm guessing most of your talk is going to focus on things that happen a little bit earlier in the chain.
Yeah, definitely. So there's, the different pieces of static analysis and dynamic scanning and that. And I think the real takeaways for me on those static analysis, I don't think it's really going to shock anybody. It's that this was always this incredibly heavyweight, burdensome control that, how we all used it in the waterfall world was you'd run static analysis once a week or once a month. It would output this 10,000 page report that the security team would forward to the development team. They'd see it was all false positives and they would just flag it as spam and ignore it.
Yeah, that sounds a pretty accurate description of the workflow there. I mean, it's got better, but like in a cartoonish look at it, that's pretty much spot on. Eh?
Exactly. Right. I think, I'm being a little bit facetious there, but yeah. I think that's certainly a scenario that plenty of us have lived.
It rings true. Let's just put it like that.
Yeah. So I think, really static analysis, the design goal for that now is that it has to be directly consumable by the development teams and DevOps teams. It's got to be fast enough to run on every code commit. And this kind of static analysis for the waterfall world, it doesn't, if it can't modernize, it doesn't make the jump into the DevOps world. Because if you're pushing code, let's just say once a day even, if you're deploying to production once a day or even once a week, trying to run a scan once a month and get really heavyweight stuff out of that, it really doesn't align with how you're doing everything else from a testing perspective.
Although I do note that a lot of these static analysis firms, they're trying to make moves in the direction of making this, something that you can use more tightly integrated in a more tightly integrated way with your development processes, right? So they're trying to get developers to use it. They've also detuned them so that they're only picking up the most egregious stuff, right? So there are some movements in those directions. How successful do you think they've been though?
I think everybody agrees on where we need to go on that one now. The individual technologies, I think there's plenty of devil in the details of, you know, particular vendor products suited for particular languages or anything
like
that.
Yeah.
But I, you know, what's funny is I think oftentimes the basics shouldn't really be overlooked here, which is a lot of times for particular technology stacks, some of your best results are basically just greps for certain known incredibly dangerous patterns.
Well, I mean, you see Silvio Cesare finding Linux kernel 0 day on Twitch live streams using like grep and, you know, text editors without syntax highlighting, right? And it's sort of, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing, right? You don't necessarily need the tool, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's one where everybody needs to go, but we're kind of in the middle of that modernization bit.
Yeah.
I think the one for me that was really surprising in terms of the kind of amount of change was the dynamic scanning side, where going back historically, we had invested a ton of time in trying to make different dynamic scanners work for our different web apps and APIs and everything there. And really what we came away with is like, look, these were really built for the previous generation style of web apps where they were very linear. You went from page one to page two to page three, and there were a few form fields and stuff like that. What I really found, and the more that I've talked to peers on this one, the more that I'm really seeing the same thing, is that the dynamic scanners, where we used to use them for vuln discovery, they're not that great for that anymore, but they can actually be used for a couple cheap and easy wins, which are things like letting you know whenever there have been regressions from certain security policies. Like, hey, for this particular app, we've said everything needs to be over TLS. So continuously crawl the site and just alert me if you ever find a link inside this domain that's pointing to plain text HTTP.
But that's not really what DAST vendors had in mind, right? Like, that's not exactly the basis on which they sell their products. So look, okay, so we've discussed some of the various components here, pen testing, bug bounties, SAST, and DAST. Now, I guess your talk today is really about like how to optimally order and use those various components as part of a complete lifecycle. First of all, where are people going wrong in terms of the emphasis that they put on each of these components? And, you know, what is the optimum order and use for each of these individual components?
Yeah, I'd say actually pulling it up a level first, which is in my mind, what defines the difference between kind of legacy security tooling and modern security tooling is that legacy security tooling was designed to only be used by security experts. So I think that would be the number one thing of usage that is not being successful inside organizations is using security tools that were only designed to be used by the security.
Look, you know, 100%, especially on the static analysis side, right? Because that was, you know, that never made sense either. Like getting security people who aren't developers to use a, you know, like a security code scanner. And that whole move now where developers are moving into that space, it caught those SAST vendors quite by surprise, I think. So that's interesting that you say that.
Yeah, I'd say it really, from that top level view, it goes into three buckets for me. It goes into the first bucket of, hey, how can we try to reduce bug count? And that needs to be directly usable by the development teams. All of these need to be directly usable. But that really goes to, you know, pulling into the development pipeline. So whether that's static analysis, whether that's some of the dynamic scanning, anything there. The second bucket is, how do we get those teams visibility into how their services are actually being abused and attacked? And then the third bucket is, how do we get them feedback loops into where their particular processes aren't really working as well as we all expected? And so that first bucket would be modernizing static analysis, modernizing dynamic scanning, those sort of pieces. The second bucket would be about kind of getting that visibility into what's going on. And that third bucket would be really, for me, it's kind of the combination of bug bounty and pen test and getting that real world attack feedback loop into where your attackers actually go and the sort of issues that they actually find.
Now, what I find fascinating about this is what you've just described, the processes that you've just described are not traditional security roles at all. Like it doesn't, these functions don't belong with a typical security group. They belong in a new security role within a development group or a development / operations group. I mean, we're talking about a new type of professional in the industry, aren't we? And look, as much as we've spoken about how, you know, security and development are coming together, it's pretty slow going out there. Trying to hire for these roles is pretty difficult. But I mean, this is what you're describing, isn't it? You're describing a new type of professional or a new class of professionals that will work across, you know, operations and development to sort of to do all of this? Because it's not going to be your typical in-house security people, is it?
Oh, it's absolutely evolving, right? I mean, if the way that we've create software has gone through a generational change, the way that we deliver software has gone through a generational change, the way that we actually need to protect those applications is now going through that generational change. And so it's absolutely evolving. What I'm seeing is kind of the commonality of the organizations that are doing this really well are the ones where they're trying to embed security people into the particular development teams or DevOps teams, either by bringing a security person and really embedding them full-time or even part-time, or they're taking individuals out of those teams and training them up on security. And then the central security group really focuses on how can they bring organization-wide capabilities as kind of a shared service across the organization.
Now that's interesting, right? Because when I think of people I know who work in application security teams, to date, by and large, I mean, there are exceptions, but mostly their job is not to actually work with the application people per se. It's to kind of oversee it and tell them they can't go live, right? Like that seems to be their function. You're saying that's changing.
I think that's absolutely changing. And, you know, just like anything else.
Is it changing or is it something that we want to change? Because there is a difference.
Oh, absolutely.
Like how real is this at the moment, you know?
Right. And it's one where the change is happening on the software creation and delivery side, which means the change has to happen on the security side. Now, whether that happens cleanly or in a very messy fashion kind of is up to the individual organization. But that change is happening, right? It's kind of like the shift to cloud and the shift to DevOps. That ship has sailed. And so if we adapt our security programs, it's kind of up to us.
Zane Lackey, thank you very much for joining us and have a really great time in Australia. We're very happy to have you in the country. You know, go and take the Manly ferry, go get a coffee in Melbourne. I'm sure you're going to love it. And we'll chat to you again soon.
Hey, thanks for having me, and thanks to the country for lowering your standards and letting me in here for a couple of weeks to give a talk. I'm really enjoying it.
That was Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that. Now, look, if you have a WAF requirement, you can use Signal Sciences, and I'd recommend that you do so. But really, you know, take a look at its other functions, particularly around that visibility piece that Zane was just referring to in that interview. Signal Sciences has built something that is very popular in DevSecOps shops. So, yeah, it's probably something you want to check out if you found yourself paying a lot of attention to what Zane was just saying in that interview. Let's put it that way. But yeah, that is it for this week's show. I'll likely be back in a couple of days with a feature interview. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.